And then it also has like major level of the servlet API. It contains a whole other bunch of JCP specs, like the web beans, which is done by JBoss, a major release of JSF and JPA, and the JAXB and JAXAbest are doing minor revisions, which is another thing I'm working on, and so on and so forth. So that's going to be one of the major features, Java E6. Another reason we are doing V3 is to improve the developer experience. So one of the things we'll be focusing on there is to continue to have the great ID integration with existing IDs. And also, we want to drastically improve the application server startup time. Today, you probably know already if you use any application server, but any one of those that's up there, if you start them, it's going to take like tens of seconds. And if you, every time you deploy, it's going to take significant time there too. So it, all in all, those things waste a lot of time from your productivity. In V3, we are working very hard to make sure that the application server starts very quickly. And continue on the theme of improving developer experience, another thing we'd like to make sure to do in V3 is to have a great Maven support in TAN support. Today, for example, in Maven, you could test your web application relatively easily by using the JetT plugin. And we wanted to do something similar for GrassFish. And for Ant, we wanted to have a better Ant task support, for example, so that you can run the application server actually inside the JVM of Ant. And in that way, you can make the testing and various automation easier. Another big theme in GlassFish V3 is the scripting language support. So this is to sort of extend the reach of JVM beyond the Java languages. So that allows you to develop things like the Ruby on Rails app, the Phobos application, which is based on JavaScript. You can also develop the PHP application and host it in there. And when you do that, the point of providing this feature is the GlassFish has the great management support so that you can monitor a large number of instances in the cluster from a remote place. You can monitor how things are going on, so if anything goes wrong, you get notified by the JMX and other connectivity, and by using third-party tools like Tivoli. And those are all built into GlassFish, which is not available in typical scripting language deployment environment. Another big benefit of using scripting language support in GlassFish V3 is because the V3 has a great ID support, as you just saw, like in Jakob's presentation. You can start the server, stop the server, deploy. You can do all those things from ID, which is, again, something that's not really available in the existing scripting language deployment. So we think that the GlassFish has a great capability in terms of the scripting language support. And there are lots of smaller features planned. Like one of the things the administration team is working on is to make sure that a different part of the application server management could be delegated to different user account. This is apparently necessary in the big deployment where you hire contractors to take care of some of the applications and so on. Another thing we are trying to do is to scale the cluster size up to 100 nodes. So you could have actually 100 server instances inside a single domain and deploy a single application and have them all run the same thing, which is, I think, none of the application server today support well. So those are the user-visible features. And to make those things possible, behind the scenes, we have to do a lot of work. One other thing, again, there is to the big emphasis we have on is the modularization. So what that allows to you is you could sort of start with small core components. For example, it's very often common that the small application just needs servlet. You don't often need JSF or the EJB and anything like that. But it often turns out that as you go, you realize that those additional components are useful to have. So by us doing the modularization, what we could offer you is when you want to start small, you could start with small set. You don't have to pay the cost of startup performance penalty or the footprint cost. But as you need it, you could add more things to it. And we have several configuration tested. So if you want, we have a few profiles that targeted for different users. So if all you want is just a servlet, that's great. We have a tested set of modules that we could provide you to do that. And if you want to grow to, let's say, include JSF or EJB, we have a different profile that gives you that, and those are well tested together so that it works. And again, the difference between the, you know, the Tomcat and adding your own stuff there is really this, the fact that we test and make sure that things work. So when you add new things, you can expect a smooth experience. And it also, well, we expect that the, you know, we be able to provide you more modules that are not part of those standard profiles, or the if things goes well, then we could have the third-party modules available as the modules. So you could also add those things as well. And from our point of view, what that also means is that we're going to be able to have a single code base that scales all the way down from like the small embedded HTTP server that you can host in your own application, all the way up to the cluster of like hundreds of instances with the, you know, the failover support and the JBI and all sorts of things like that. Another thing is, well, some and other vendors are introducing a lot of middlewares that are expected to run on the server. So the JBI is one of those that's very useful if you want to orchestrate the complex web services. We're also working on the voice over IP support for Java called the SIP support. So those are developed as those could be developed as the extension of, well, on top of this extensible V3 system. And what that would allow us is to sort of have a very smooth integration between those extensions and core port. And that should translate to a better, you know, user experience for you guys. So in a way, what we are trying to do here is to essentially repeat what happened to IDEs in the application servers. So for example, I think the previous generation of IDEs, like JBuilders, they were essentially developed as a single monolithic application. And so there is a clear differentiation between this core IDE plus the other things that the people add. But in modern IDEs, like, you know, the NetBeans and Eclipse, essentially everything is a module. So you could pretty much strip away everything to the point that it's no longer an IDE. So we are really trying to do the same thing, but still sort of provide the seamless integrated experience to the end users. So for that purpose, we're working a lot and spending a lot of time, and this is where I spend most of the time, to sort of come up with a good mechanism that allows module developers to define extensibility so that they could develop those extensible applications, extensible modules more easily. And so that means a significant infrastructure improvements from the V2 code base. So in the end, we hope that that would let us deliver a better quality, more integrated modules to you in more quicker way. So with that overview behind us, I wanted to show you the current prototype that we are working on. So so one of the big improvements we have is that you can actually start the GlassFish like that, the Java Jar thing. And I'll start that, and it's going to be running in less than a second. So that's a full application server written right there. So see, it's less than a second, and compare that with your application server you're using today. And I hope this is convincing enough. All right, so this, well, unfortunately, I haven't deployed anything yet, so this doesn't actually run anything interesting. So so I have this dummy, fairly dummy web application that I wrote. In fact, I didn't write. I asked Maven to write it for me. So that's just, I think the only thing it has is is that it? Yeah, this simple HTML file, the high HTML. So, so I could deploy it like normally I do normally, and it started running there. I think I should probably undeploy it to see, to make sure that it's gone. So now it's gone. So I request the same page and it's no longer found. Another thing I could do is, this has a great scripting language support, so let's deploy some JRuby application. And I'm gonna have to cheat because I don't remember the exact path. But so the Mephist is, I think the weblog application, the blog application written in JRuby. It's actually a Ruby on Rails app. So this I checked out in my workspace. I'm going to deploy this to the application server. And the JRuby is going to take its time to get ready. It actually takes some time to deploy, but that's okay because in scripting application, you don't have to redeploy to, you know, to make changes reflected. So, all right, so now if I request a page, I think I hopefully it should come back. Yes, okay. So that's the JRuby application running on V3. And if I undeploy this too, Mephisto, I forgot the Y. So as I undeploy Mephisto 07. Okay, I got extra 3 in there. So as I undeploy applications, the container would garbage collect all the JRuby code. So next time I start a run, it's still back to the same grid startup performance. So I hope you like that. You know, it's the we all want to be more productive, so this should hopefully help. And where did my yes. So that's the kind of thing we are working on, and so we are very conscious about the speed speed in which the application server starts. So the foundation of all this work is the module system that we are working on called HK2 for 100 kilobyte kernel. It's loosely based on the work of JSR277, which is the targeted for Java SE7, is going to define the module system for Java. But unfortunately, we can't wait for the Java SE7 to deliver this, so we have to do our own thing. And this JSR277 is still under the active development. We added the hook so that we can sort of interoperate with existing module system, like the OSGI and the Maven has its own module system too. So like if you have existing OSGI bundles that you need to run on GlassFish, we could do so. And you can similarly sort of take advantage of services inside GlassFish V3 from your OSGI code if that's how you are used to develop those things. Right now the HK2 runs on Java SE5, although in the final version the GlassFish V3 would require Java SE6. So the module is internally essentially really like the NetBeans module system. The fact that we have to loosely base things on JSR277 makes it difficult for us to do anything radically different. It's identified that each module is identified by a name and a version. And when you run multiple modules, the implementation, this HK2 system, would make sure that it set up a class loader in isolated fashion and the necessary dependency gets satisfied and all that. So these are all common features you can see in many module systems. And it could also specify what other modules that it depends on by using the name and version so that the proper version resolution happens at the runtime. And all these information are captured in the JAR file manifest so that the system could access it. So the modules are at runtime represented by this module instance in the system. We have two class loaders so that the one has the externally visible thing which hides the internal details and the internal one that does the delegation and so on. And the modules have the list of the other class loaders so that the import could handle accordingly. And the writing this kind of stuff is a bit tricky because the class loader is assumed to have only one parent. So making sure that everything works correctly, it takes a bit of work, but I think we nailed that. And so the things are also made designed so that when all the references to the particular class loader gets released and the class loader itself gets garbage collected, this is essential in this module system where we wanted to add the modules and remove the modules as we go. The modules are bundled into this thing called repository. Again, I think this is not a new concept. Then we could add the repositories at the runtime. So the way we use it is, for example, we package the entire web tier, like the servlet, into a single repository. And we package, let's say, the entire EJB into another repository. So you could if you don't need EJB, like you could scratch away the whole EJB directory and that eliminates all the EJB related modules. Or if you needed to download, let's say, JVI, it comes with a bunch of modules in the repository, so you could copy its directory in the GrassFish directory, and that's it. And this abstraction also allows us to have a repository in different physical format. So the one that's going to be used in the production would be the one that looks at the directory, just like Eclipse or NetBeans. But internally, we have other implementation, like the one that's based on Maven. So when you are sort of launching GlassFish from Maven, we could pick up all the modules from the Maven repository and boot from nowhere. So that allows us to, you know, for example, do deliver a great user experience. Like when you type Maven GlassFish run, it downloads the, essentially the entire GlassFish V3 from the Maven repository, and so you don't have to do any separate installation step whatsoever. It also gives us flexibility in terms of how we boot GlassFish. I already showed you that we could boot in java-jar, but in case of implementing V3 as the Maven plugin, we're going to be booting from the Maven repository. We could also pack everything up into a single jar, which is great if you want to embed GlassFish V3 into your application, and so on. So as a result, in the bootstrapping, we don't have to set this long list of class paths anymore. You could just do the java-jar or GlassFish jar, and it sort of bootstraps the module system, and it finds all the necessary modules from the proper places, and it gets going. And the whole thing happens very quickly, too. So this whole notion of the module system is designed to sort of take advantage of Maven 2. So each GlassFish module is built as a single Maven module. And because the Maven contains a lot of the metadata about the project, we can actually utilize that information a lot to create the necessary metadata for the module. So that includes things like the name and version, because, how many of you use Maven? Do you? Okay, so good. Yeah, so you probably already know that the Maven project each has a name and versions, and the explicit dependency about what it depends on the other things, which happens to be the exact information we need at the runtime. So when we are writing modules, we don't have to repeat those same information all over again. So this is the format in which you can write the dependency information in POM. To write the module, you'd say the packaging as the HK2 jar, whereas normally you'd say just jar. So this tell Maven that these are the extra processing that it needs to perform to create the metadata or things like that. And it sort of our processor, our Maven plugins, would turn this into all these metadata available in the manifest file. So you might be able to see that the import information and so on became a part of the manifest. So with this setup, what we were able to do is the developers no longer need to build the whole GlassFish. And people could just check out the part that they are interested in working on and make some changes and build the module, and they could launch GlassFish from there. This is also convenient when you need to make a small modification in GlassFish. It often happens that you're using something as your dependency and you discover some issue that you really need to get fixed like tomorrow. And the only way you can do it is often you patch the issue by yourself. And if the whole thing involves in complex build process that requires like the different tool installations and so on, that wouldn't be very practical. But since everything is built as a Maven module and you could check out things individually, it gives you a great ability to do these things. Using Maven 2 also allows us to do a fair amount of source code processing at the build time. So some of the things we do is, for example, do the code generation for internationalization purposes, and we actually generate the bytecode and then post-process some of those. And we rely on the extensive annotation processing because a lot of our internal infrastructure depends on Java 5 annotations. And finally, all those manifest metadata generation is all done at this build-time processing. And the whole thing kicks in just by writing this package HK2JAR, and you don't have to do anything more to write them. And also internally, well, we often want to like enforce certain rules between those modules. For example, one of them is to make sure that all the modules have fine bugs run so that we can catch silly mistakes up front. And doing those below the easier is Maven. The other things to use this information is the manager likes to see these pretty pictures. right? So so we feel that this like the lead the developer information in the form so that the management could see, you know, which module is worked by whom. I actually generated also the nice dependency graph that sort of fills up a big paper. And so if you put that in the world, the people would sort of... And the same theme extends not only just building modules, but building the GlassFish distribution, meaning a set of modules with the shell scripts and all the files that you need to run something. So we could actually write the distribution, so the assembled distribution, just by writing POM, and again specifying what modules we want by listing dependencies. So we use that to produce different bundles, like the small servlet container bundle to the EJB bundle to like the Java E6 bundle to and so on and so forth. But you could also use this to create the custom distribution of GlassFish V3. And this might be useful where you need to like have a very special needs that where the, you need a certain exact set of modules that deploys needs to be deployed to the large number of systems. Then actually creating a distribution might make sense. Or if you're, for people OEM, doing OEM of the GlassFish, they could like swap in the company logo and they could claim that that's their work and that sort of things. And the build time, well, so we wanted to make our lives easier too. So one of the work we did relatively early on is to write this HK2 repository backed by the Maven repository. So during the development, like we installed a particular module through Maven, and that goes into your local Maven repository. And when we run it, that's where we could pick up all the modules from there. Plus, if there's anything missing in the local repository, the Maven would download from our central place. So even if you don't, even if people don't build the whole thing, you could still get things going. And initially, well, so this was somewhat painful, because if you use Maven, you probably know that it has a lot of quirks, and often you need to, like, the documentation kind of sucks, and so you have to see the source code to see what's going on and so forth. So initially, we had some hit in making this work, but eventually we got to the point that compared to our existing GlassFish way of building, this became more productive. So while working on the Java E5, well, one of the things we get jealous was that you guys get the great IOC support from Spring and all the Java E notation support and so on, but we don't get any. So in the Java E6, we are doing a revenge and we are implementing an IOC service for ourselves. So one of the concepts there is to this have notion of service loader pattern on steroids. So the service loader pattern is where you have, like, it's something you often use to define extension points where, you know, you designate one type as a base class and you discover implementation at the runtime by looking at this meta in services, blah, blah, blah. So we did that, and this is actually extensively used internally because a lot of things are indeed extensible. So, for example, the containers, that's an internal term we use to represent a different kind of hosting environment. You know, servlet is hosted in one way, EJBs are hosted in another way, scripting application yet in another way. So there is an internal extension point, and this is using the service loader pattern. The asadmin command, that from the command line, you can do various things against the running application server. Those are also used by these things. Those are also implemented by using these features. So in V3, these work by using annotation. So on the base type, you would say put at contract, indicating that this is something meant to be extended. And on the concrete implementation, you'd put at service. In the build time, we look at all the source files and discover all the contracts and the implementations and generate necessary metadata so that the runtime could pick up. So we don't actually have to write the meta in services file manually anymore. We could also have services named. So for example, in the CLI commands, every command has a sub-command identified by a name. So the way we can add a new command is by writing this class and put this at service with name annotation. And that suffices to add any command. And it works just like any other commands in the system. So let's say when the JBI team or even you wanted to write some commands that, for example, dump some statistics information from the application server, you could just create a Maven module. We can provide the archetype for that, and then write this single class and package that into type maven install, and it creates a jar file, and you put that in the lib directory, and you have successfully installed your module into GlassFish. So this makes a lot of things easier. The other thing we do is the injection, so that we don't have to constantly look for doing abc.getabc or the def.getdec to get to the object that we want. So we defined the annotation-based injection scheme where you could say at inject to get a relevant object injected. And also we could look after the same thing by programmatically, for example, by specifying a name. Another thing we did work on is, well, the application server takes the configuration in terms of XML file called domain.xml. That's a single file that's listing all the information like, which port to run HTTP service and how many instances we have in the cluster and what kind of application we got deployed and so on. So we implemented this rather infrastructure level service to parse this kind of configuration XML and read it as a component wiring just like the Spring or the Apache XP does. But this is this is still based on Java EE, and we also do that by extensively using annotations. And to sort of parse configuration as fast as possible. The reason we couldn't rely on, let's say, Spring or other existing environment to do this is those IOC frameworks are designed for applications where you want to sort of where you could afford to load everything up front. In fact, by the time your application gets deployed, the application server already has created a class server that's capable of loading everything. But when we are implementing the application server itself, we didn't want to load everything just because the application server is capable of providing. In fact, this Java-jar, GlassFish jar that I showed you earlier loaded everything in the GlassFish, then it wouldn't start in 1 second. So the scheme in which we do this is to carefully make sure that we are not loading anything we don't need right away. So this doing lazy loading correctly requires us to essentially do some of these things by ourselves. So despite the fact that, so the end result is, when we read the configuration XML, we almost don't read anything from the module systems. But despite the fact, we still manage to validate XML, for example, so that if you make any typo in this configuration XML file, we can tell you right away, which is wasn't crucial. It also has support like the ID, IDF kind of semantics where you could have this part of the file referring to another. It also has like variable substitution like ans so that you could have the common constant defined elsewhere. And it's also designed to be extensible so that, for example, you could when you add a new thing, for example, let's say the security view is often custom implemented. So we sit with, let's say, the JDBC security VM, the file security VM, and so on, but people often write different things like the LDAP-based one. When you add those things into GlassFish, you could have them configured from the same domain XML by using the exact same syntax that the rest of the system uses. So it also helps us to keep the system extensible. The service has a typical lifecycle method that you guys might already be familiar with, the EJB and so on, where you can get a callback after the object is constructed, or right before it's destroyed. And those are all available to all systems, all service components. So all in all, the way it works is, when the system realizes that someone needs this object, we create an instant, we do all the injections, and then we call the post-construct to give it a chance to finalize its initialization. And then we start pulling out the resources that it offers and register into this component system. And the reverse direction happens when we destruct a component. So we remove it from the public visibility. We also remove all the extracted resources. And we call pre-destroy and let the garbage collector finish its job. So in this way, because when everything is injection based, you could actually, so this works very well with the notion of lazily doing it. So instead of programs proactively fetching an object, which causes a cascading effect of eager reloading everything, if they iteratively specify what to load, you could load these things lazily without the module level first write anything special. So in that way, we also win. The component has scopes against the next Spring,
And scope is also a component on its own. So you could write the custom scopes, like the scopes tied to a certain application or the various instances of the domain. So in the end, I wanted to show some of the internal abstraction that we use so that you could get some idea about our seriousness in doing the things. So the one of the abstraction that we spend a lot of time on is to make sure that the different kind of containers could be part on. So this is for use. This is used for things like, you know, scripting language support and the EJB support and the servlet support. So when we look at when the user tells GlassFish to deploy this to archive, you're going to have this old sniff for it, which is extension point internally, to have a look at all the files. And one of them says, yes, I could handle those, and that sniff for gets responsible for setting up and deploying it. So the reason we call it sniff for is because it's like, you know, you don't know what this archive is, so you sort of sniff it to see if you could make sense out of it. So once it's discovered, well, so the setup is called to make sure that the environment is set up. So again, we don't want to load anything legally, so we actually don't load the container until we find that there are some application that actually needs that service. So the setup is typically the point in which we load the additional repository to, let's say, you know, if it's a EJB module, then at that point we start adding the EJB repository into the GlassFish and then loading those systems and initializing them. And then the deployer, then the things gets turned over to the another extension point called deployer, which sort of takes it from there and actually prepare the runtime environment. And when we undeploy the application, the reverse things happen in the reverse order. So we call this sniffer.tlm so that it could release the repository, and that at that point it's ready to be garbage collected. And things gets back to the previous state in which you didn't have this, let's say, JDB or JDB repository, that where you only have a small portion of the system. So it's thanks to those cascading startup effects, the startup is got simpler. We don't have to say, it used to be that there's a fairly long part of the code where, you know, it goes on to initialize IELP and it goes on to initialize the JMS and EJB and subnet and so on. But now it's all just extension pointed. The only thing that the startup does is just to request all these startup services. And what that happened is this triggers this instantiation of all the startup services. And then that way each module gets initialized without having this bootstrap code know nothing about what actually goes on. The shutdown is essentially the other way around. Now we sort of remove all the startup services, which is the essentially works like the root reference in the garbage collector. So if you remove them all, everything gets eliminated from the system and it could safely shut down. So that was the kind of implementation details, because you know, this is still very much work in progress. I couldn't show more, you know, user visible fancy features other than the demo I showed earlier. But to wrap this up, so the GlassFish V3 is the decomposition of the Java EE application server, so that you could just, you know, pay as you go. That is, you only pay for the feature you use. And this also works well with the theme of Java EE with the profiles and so on. We are spending a lot of effort to make sure that you could have a great edit build device cycle without wasting your time. And the system is extensible so that we can host all kinds of different containers, not just the traditional servlet EJB thing, but in addition to those, we wanted to support scripting languages. We wanted to make GlassFish embeddable, again, so that you can, for example, have it from the Maven plugin or the ANT task and so on. It's based on the module system that we are working on, which emphasizes more on lazy loading so that we could enable this pay-as-you-go model. And there's a lot of interesting techniques we use internally to make this module system interesting. And you can actually download what's available today, so you can actually verify yourself that this server runs less than a second on MLC and hopefully. And if you're interested in more information, so those are the project site that we are working doing this work. The HK2 site is where we create the module system. The GlassFish website is where you can download the distribution, and you can also see the source code if you're interested in. Wiki has a more detailed instruction about how you can install and, you know, and run some Ruby on Rails apps and sort of that things. Is that? I think it's that's it. So I guess if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
I would like to ask you if there are any plans for better support for web hosting companies, because currently it is quite a problem to find web hosting services.
Yeah.
Java EE support.
Yes. So if there are any great questions. Yes. In fact, for example, one of the earlier example where I showed this role-based authentication is, for example, for ISPs. So the, you know, typical hosting environment, they don't give you the whole, they can't give you the whole VM to use. So a single GraphQL instance needs to be shared by multiple users. And when you do that, you have to make sure that the user A can't go mess up the user B's application. So this kind of role-based of the access control and the admin would help them do that. So there are certain features planned along those lines. But beyond that, but to be honest, I think some of it is essentially the Java programming, that it's not as hard to find a hosting for GlassFish, but in fact, it's often hard to find hosting for any Java EE containers. So that's not something we can change by having a, you know, great application. So there's a limit in which you can do it. So I don't suddenly expect Java EE to like replace a PHP hosting availability. But we are making progress to make sure that the hosting company could provide easy Java support. So.
And what about things like application isolation? It means that it would be possible to reserve only some limited amount of resources to one application. Or so?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think Java essentially is not designed to scale that way. That is, like, despite the fact that it's often common in Spring language world, that is, when you're hosting PHP, for example, you could afford to fork a lot of processes. So it's very common to have a single server hosting lots of PHP apps for different people. But the Java application is difficult to have multiple instances running on the same system. It helps that this is sort of pay-as-you-go model, in the sense that when you're not running the JD or the JMS application, then you don't have to pay the cost of loading those things. So that helps us to reduce the footprint. But whether that's small enough to be, you know, to be so that to the point that you can host, let's say, like 2 dozen instances in one single dual core system, I don't know. So there's an inherent challenge in making Java work with isolation. And I think I believe some, so Java is feasible, there is some work in progress to have a better isolation among applications. So eventually in the Java C7 timeframe, we might be able to take advantage of some of those to, you know, make sure that this works better. But now there is still room for improvements.
Thanks.
Are there any plans of doing something like Java Redol does? So if I want to, I don't want to firstly reload my application, but I want to propagate the changes I've made to run the application live.
Yeah, possibly I wish some Visor company, isn't it? But yes, they have some very interesting technique, and I think we actually sort of keep close eye on it. So hopefully we might be able to, well, yeah, I probably shouldn't commit anything, but so we are really sort of looking at it very closely. So, and Java, we are working with Java SE hotspot team to see, you know, what kind of things we can do. So we'll see. I'm sort of, yeah, it's hard to say. I hope you get that, you read between my lines.
Okay. I have one another question. How difficult was to switch from your original build system to Maven?
So it actually helped in this case, because the V2 from V2 to V3 involved in a significant code change anyway. So it was sort of, we could tie everything back into one. If this was like just an incremental improvement, then it might have been much tougher. And again, I think there are a fair amount of initial curve. I did enough Maven hacking by the time I started working on this bit. So I knew a fair amount, so that helped. But I got to the point where I had the entire Maven source code checked out, and so that I could debug into Maven and so on. So initially, it really was painful. And there are still some issues, but I think in the end, it went quite all right. So I guess, are you thinking about doing the similar conversion as well?
Oh no! All my project already uses Maven. I was only curious.
Okay. Yes. And I guess a part of it is like the training people. At least once they get used to the certain way you're working, it's kind of hard to convince them the other ones. So, but so I don't know. It's all clumped together, so I couldn't really like quantify how much time this.
So what is the size of the glassfish team and what methodology are you using?
It really depends on how you count. So the way it works is, even though we sort of finished, well, we released the Bluetooth, there are still like the bug fixes and the additional next releases to that line. So what happens is that the people keep getting pulled back into this older version, so there's constant fighting between the Bluetooth team and the V3 team about who belongs to them. So even not many people work on this full time, I think. But all in all, I guess already maybe, I don't know, 3 dozen or so people working in and out. So, but it's hard to say. I guess I don't even know the entire people. It's sort of split into pieces. And it's also involved in different geographies. So it's often hard to count exactly how many people are involved. Like, there's like multiple David and multiple Petra and so on. So that also makes it hard to kind of
And to the methodology? And to the methodology question, what methodology are you using for some?
Methodology?
Yeah.
That's a very broad question.
Some homegrown.
Let's see, what methodology do you have? So I guess you want to. But it's hard to say this in meaningful terms. For example, we could say that we do test-driven development because we write a lot of tests. Or we could say we do really the other development because I guess that we do the continuous integration and so on. So maybe that's the kind of thing you wanted to hear. But I think it's often pointless to talk about, let's say, this test-driven development, extreme programming, unless you actually quantify which part of it you do, because people do many different things by that. So, if you have some particular aspects that you're interested in, I'd be happy to talk more about it, but it's a bit too generic too.
I was mostly interested in analysis phase, okay? how the project plan is divided, okay? If you have a big analytical part in the beginning and then you are going,
I see.
Ongoing process.
Yeah, so our marketing guy is always sort of maintain contact with the customer. So that's not just during like this early stage of the design, but throughout all the phases of the development. So they usually have good indication about what they are hearing from their customers. And so the initial version gets created based on those inputs. And we posted that on the wiki, and we asked the people in the users community that, these are the future requirements for the V3 and what you guys think. And that's where it actually got very popular, and I think we saw some tremendous number of response to those. And so we devised those requirements documents based on those. And then so at that point we have sort of for each technology area we have that list of things that we wanted to do. Like so at early on we know that we need to scale to let's say 100 instances. And so that's a sort of basic given requirement. And then from then on sort of the engineer started thinking about how we could do this, and if we do some of these, maybe we can do the other things too. And in that way, we managed to add a few new things. Like one of the things we recently started thinking about is to do the monitoring support like V3 stuff. So it lets you run a small script inside the application sort of to obtain information. So those all came from more like engineers because we thought we could do it. So it's a combination of input from the customers because we need to get paid, and the input from the community because that's often how we talk to the developers in the trends. and then input from us engineers about what we should be doing. Mm-hmm. So, and then we usually adjust those, and you know, the reality is that if a timeline deadline gets nearby, we can't delay the release too much either. So certain things get dropped from the release list or added and so on. But that, roughly speaking, that's how we develop.
So that's all. Thank you.